Welcome to Editing Loud with South Africa's best editors and journalists. Guys, the story of the week has clearly been the Public Investment Corporation, which invests 1.9 trillion of government employees' pension funds. But it's been much in the news because of political interference and being linked to state capture. Ron, what is the background? Where do we stand? What's been happening at the PIC that has created such a fuss?
Well, the context is it's a state that doesn't have access to it's basically broke. I'm going to call it broke, it's a stronger word, maybe. Yeah, exactly. They're struggling to find money. It's short of money, and they see the 1.9 trillion worth of assets that PIC has that manages, and they're thinking that's a way they'll get funds to solve their SOE crisis. And that's, but right now, the urgent one is SAA. There's ESCOM coming up. So we have a new minister in Treasury who's gone into the PIC and basically urging them to find ways of bailing out their struggling SOEs. But that's probably the most urgent crisis sitting with the country and state. So.
Tim, is that a legitimate use of government employees' pensions?
No. Well, you see, the second half of the story is that, of course, the head of the pension fund, or the head of the government agency that runs the pension fund as a fund manager, Dan Majila. There was press leaks last week that he'd lent money to his friends, and we've seen this movie 100 times before. Somebody doesn't like somebody in a top job. They leak some embarrassing information about him. With a serious look on their faces, all of the parliamentarians jump in, and then they kick the guy out or the woman out, and then they put their person in, and then all of a sudden the gushes just open. And
well, wait, this sounds like a guy called Pravin Gordhan, right?
That is exactly it. And, you know, sort of several before him. So last week when we saw all of these sort of sudden press leaks that Dan Majila had, you know, was a terrible boss and had given himself extra bonuses and had given loans to his friends, so that we all knew exactly where this, you know, what this picture was supposedly showing us. So so last week there were a string of stories culminating, I think, in your publication, if I've got it right,
yes,
of the state of this battle. So it's pretty transparent. The Treasury wants Dan Majila out, but they don't want to look like they're kicking him out anyway. Dan Majila wants to stay in, and he doesn't want to look as though he's trying to, you know, defend himself by going public on the. But the fact is that the PIC has had applications from a string of state-owned enterprises for funding. It's done it before. It's lent money to the state-owned enterprises before, but now it's transparent that they are broke. And they are, and so now the complexion of the applications are totally different. Am I right?
In that story in the Sunday Times, Business Times, Dan Majila was interviewed, and he was quoted as saying that the people want him out because he holds the key to the safe, the biggest safe in the country. Yeah. Is that right, Ron? I mean, what else did he say that brought some people up?
Basically, that's what he came out and said. I know he's denied that subsequently, but he came out and said, look, these guys are after the keys, and I own the keys. And that all this negative press around him, which is clear, it's a way of removing him from his position. We stand behind the story and on that's what he said. So this is the gameplay. We'll see in the next couple of days how it unfolds and what. Isn't he supposed to be releasing a statement any time soon with regards to what came out yesterday at the press conference?
So the press conference is fascinating. Yeah. I mean, Sikonathi, you were there yesterday where Gigaba stood up with Daniel Majila, the Minister of Finance, with Daniel Majila and his deputy, Sifiso Buthelezi, who's the chairman of the PIC. And what actually happened at that press conference? It was an hour late, as you pointed out to Gigaba.
It was an hour 20 minutes late. So you can imagine what was going on to delay the whole press conference that Gigaba himself had scheduled for 2 o'clock. 3:20 we started, and there he was, Maihlome, trying to tell us to ask one question each because the minister is pressed for time. Anyway, they all sang from this hymn, a very big one. We are all is hunky-dory, we're very happy people. The minister has got full confidence in the board and in management, and management has got full confidence in the minister and the board, and the board has got full confidence in the minister and management. You guys are just causing trouble. But he singled out Daniel Machila when it was his turn to speak. He singled out a publication called Business Times, edited by our great friend here, Ron Davey, and denied flatly everything that had been published in the main story. So I, because Ron was not there and Chris Barron was not there, I asked him exactly what part of that article was inaccurate. 900 words, which part of that? He said, I will issue a statement. We are still waiting for that statement. But he did, in that same briefing, repeat some of the things he had apparently said in the story that he now denies, that SAA is uninvestable. It's it's corporate governance leaves a lot to be desired, and it's way below investment grade, and there's no way they can invest there. Only until SAA sorts out its governance problems, returns to investment grade, starts making money, we are guaranteed our return that we are mandated by GEPF to get 6% plus inflation plus 2%. Then we can invest, and the same goes for Eskom. But he denies the story as being inaccurate, designed to drive a wedge between himself and the finance minister, and between himself and the board. And indeed, he's got full confidence in all of them, as they do to him.
So Ray, is that, I mean, does it indicate what's actually happening, and why did he do that when it seems pretty obvious that he did say those things? I mean, why would he do that? Is that a bid to keep his job?
It's mystifying. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, I have no idea. I mean, my guess is that a deal was reached. Okay, look, we'll back off. This thing is embarrassing. It's causing a lot of, we'll back off. You just better go and deny that story. It's very uncomfortable what you said there.
Yeah.
And then we'll just keep quiet, and then we'll do this behind the scenes and sort it out over the next few months.
Otherwise, we'll declare an irretrievable breakdown in relationship, and one of us is not going to be here next time we meet. And that is not the minister, and that is not the board. It is one person, the one who went to the media and said, we are all after him.
We called it
in the financial mail, it's a draw.
What I don't understand is you don't want your CEO. You don't like your CEO. Why isn't there like a conversation behind closed doors and try to get Majela to step down without any of this negative press coverage? This is, you know, when Mugabe was there at DPE, almost all those CEOs had it's played the same way out, right? Comes out first, and then there's an acting CEO. Why can't you sit down? Come there, okay, fine. PIC, right now we can't operate with Dan, because Dan is following whatever party is following, which isn't in line with what Gabba wants. Why can't you sit down in the back room and talk and get him to resign and get paid off?
Let's
like
be more specific.
Silently. I don't get this.
Where Gabba goes, he appoints two or three board members first, and then a few weeks later, there's a scandal against key people in management. Go to Transnet, go to SAA, go to Eskom when he was DPE minister. Same script is playing out again, except this time around, the reason there is a draw between him and management, they did not anticipate the resistance that they have now gotten from the public. And that's why there's a draw.
That's a crucial issue. And I mean, 1.9 trillion rand is a lot of money. It is the safe, basically, to the country. So why is it important that Majila stays?
Well, you know, the thing is that they've got, you know, the situation is completely different. You know, the PIC, when government looks at the PIC, they see 1.8 trillion rands worth of money that, you know, that they could, they see a huge pot of gold that they can go and sort of draw from. But the PIC is not the controller of the money. The controller of the money is the state pension fund itself.
Yeah.
They are the investor of the money. They're in a different position to Transnet. Transnet is making its own decisions about how it allocates its budget. The PIC is responsible to a different organization outside of government for maintaining investment returns. And so there's a whole different authority structure, there's a whole different accountability structure which lies behind the relationship between the PIC and government and, you know, this pot of money. But I mean, you know, the thing is that you, and what you're dealing with here, there's also a political dimension to this, because what you're dealing with here is the pension funds of state employees. You know, so the state employees have an enormous vested interest in making sure that the PIC does not invest its money in, you know, in bankrupt organizations that happen to be a, you know, an embarrassment for government at some particular point.
What is funny is COSATU is the is the employees, right? And yeah. COSATU has stood up against Zuma and against state capture. So they also find this, so if anything needs to be captured for this for a kick up to get access is the pension fund, but now it's a
fascinating anecdote in that story that he was talking about where Dudumieni, the chairwoman of SAA, calls him apparently, Daniel Majila, a few weeks ago and says, we need 6 billion rand for SAA, and Daniel Majila refuses and says, like he reiterated yesterday, that it's not investable.
Yeah.
I mean, surely that indicates that that the PIC is a lot closer to the state capture project than anyone believes. Ray, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Is that a correct assessment?
I think the avenues, you know, their choices now are to go and raise money on the markets at a very expensive rate because you're worse than junk. I mean, you know, shudder to think what kind of interest you would get in a bond attached to SAA at the moment. Mm. I don't even know if there'd be any takers.
That's not bond.
But there would be. No, but I'm just saying, if you know, how would you? How else would you raise the money? Right?
Well, there is an option, and this is also the kind of interesting part of it. Because
besides bank robbery, because that is
no. I mean, government does still have a big stake. It has a 23% stake in Telkom.
39.
So,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. The plan B with the PIC was for the PIC to take over the stake in Telkom, and then government will use. The proceeds to pay for SAA. But the problem is that the PIC is very invested in Telkom already, as it is invested in a lot of other sort of companies. And the upside is, you know, the upside is probably all in the share. You know, they have to try and weigh the potential purchase of Telkom shares against. You know, the hundreds of other possible investments out there.
Let's just say it would buy that whole stake. It's only worth about 12 billion rand. SAA alone needs 13 billion rand, but 10 billion rand as in right now. SAPC and all of them. Now, let's bring context again. The PIC already owns 13% of Telkom, and it cannot exceed 15%. If they wanted to, they would make a special case in order to breach that mandate and to make an offer to minorities because they would now be over control. But the biggest part is now. So you only get 12 billion rand when you know this guy is sitting with 1.9 trillion rand and you need at least 100 billion rand, as that Business Times story did state so very well that now Machila denies. And 1 trillion rand, Rob, is 12 zeros. Put your money there, 1.9 and 12 zeros, that's what it is. It's 1,000.
And like, you know, like the thing is, you want 100 billion. So within that 1.9 worth of assets, you have to liquidate stuff, right? Mm. So what do you, I think that's where government fails to understand. So what do you liquidate to raise 100 billion odd rand from? So what do you sell? What stakes more beyond Telkom, beyond, so all these, what properties do you sell? What other,
like. You sell Sunderland bonds. That's nobody would buy.
Signati, who has to leave in the second half of the show, your view is Daniel Majila safe for now or not?
For now, but I mean, he's on very, very, very thin ice. He's not going to be there long enough if Malusi Gigaba stays, if that board with Buthelezi and Kwame Mkhwanazi and Sibusiswe Zulu is there. Sibusiswe Zulu, by the way, is a lawyer to Zweli Mkhize and all of them and comes from the Umgeni Water Board.
Okay, well, you heard it here first. And join us in the second half for some more compelling insights. Welcome back to Editing Aloud. And guys, to start off this segment, we're going to talk about the Rugby World Cup. There's been a lot of discussion about whether South Africa should host it again after doing such a great job in 1995, which was a long time ago, and dare I say, pre-Zuma. Ray, your thoughts on whether it's a good thing to do? There are various issues in our rugby sector. We have not, rugby industry, so to speak. We have poor transformation record, and the big events we've hosted so far haven't exactly been fantastic for us, such as the 2010 World Cup. What are your thoughts on doing it now?
No, I think that as an event, it would be very, it would make sense. It makes more sense than the 2010 World Cup did because we have all the stadiums, so there's no new stadiums to build. So the chances of infrastructure spend going out of control are less, so there might be some renovation. But having said that, when government signs guarantees up front to pay for everything and there's an actual physical deadline, there is a tendency for people to overspend because there's no choice. Mm. You know, whatever has to be done has to be done. If it's got to be broadcast 4K probably by 2023, I should imagine they'd want to put this out 4K. You know, there's huge communications infrastructure that has to be put in to enable that to take place in the stadiums. So these events tend to really open up the opportunity for leverage and arbitrage from construction companies and the like.
As we saw in the 2010 World Cup, where there was a raft of collusion allegations that arose because of it.
I think there you had stadiums built from the ground up at massive cost, and here you don't have that. You don't need more rugby stadiums than what we have to host a World Cup.
But Tim, do you think the 2010 World Cup was any good for us? We spent a lot of money and got arguable value back for it.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that I quite like the idea, to be honest. I know that there's questions about rugby's transformation and so on. But, you know, and there are, as Ray says, you know, opportunities for arbitrage and so on. It's such a tourism, you know, boost, and television ratings for rugby are going up, and you know it's kind of a chance to put on an international festival. You know, and you can sort of see that because there's a lot of very competitive you know bids to host the tournament, and we don't have the you know, we don't have to build the stadium, so you know this the possibility of arbitrage is less than it was. The only difference that I have with Ray is over the pluralization of stadium, because he said stadiums and I think it's stadia. Mm. I just like to put that.
I'm glad that we're focusing on the important.
Yeah, we need to focus on the stuff, you know, not the irrelevant issues like, you know, money and.
You glossed over transformation, but isn't that a thing that our sporting codes haven't really transformed? We're not really including a lot of the population in some codes like cricket, like rugby. And perhaps even golf, dare I suggest.
But in terms of with rugby, they've been doing pretty. Looks much better on the field, right? But I'm sure. By 2023, hosting a World Cup, I think I'm with Tim on this one. Yeah, I think it'll be good for the country generally. I think.
Shocker.
We have all the stadia. It's all been built. What's the point of just keeping it? So, and it keeps it on the world map. But I was looking at just the health of South African rugby financially. I think South African rugby needs to host the World Cup. It looks, even All Black rugby is in the red, right? So for the health of the sport itself, so I have no issue at all raising. However, we did fail to raise money to host the Commonwealth Games, right? Yeah. So it's a very tricky balance, but at least 2023 is so far out that hopefully.
Being that with the Commonwealth Games, there were no bidders except for us.
Yeah, that's true.
There was, and then we even said, no.
No, we can't afford this thing.
There is a big transformation issue in rugby, and that is, can we transform ourselves into a team that beats the All Blacks?
Yes, ever. We do it every 28 years. Won't it be better if we don't have the World Cup here, and then we can be beaten on somewhere else?
I think the biggest reason we should host the World Cup is that we can treat the All Blacks to a delicious curry.
Yeah, the night before the game. Before the final. That would be.
Yeah, that's great. Assuming we get to the final again. But Ray, I mean, you wrote a book about the 2010 World Cup. And one of the issues with that World Cup that's still dogging us is the fact that there was corruption in that one, that there was allegation of a $10 million bribe paid to certain people. I mean, how do you keep corruption out of mega events like this?
Well, transparency is the answer. You know, it would be great if we could see very clearly how the money that's been allocated for this World Cup is spent. And that even though SARU is a private organization, I think they should come clean and make absolute clean breast of every cent that's spent, And they should get KPMG in to audit
yeah.
the whole process from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Then they'll definitely make money.
I was moving on to something different. We had this week, we had the third CEO of a construction company resigning from Avenge this week, following the likes of Group 5 a couple of months ago. Ron, your thoughts on what this says about our construction industry. Does anyone want to be a CEO of a big company anymore? Why are people falling like flies? The current CEO who left yesterday, he'd only been in the job 3 years and said he's tired. I mean, how can you be tired after 3 years in the job?
It tells a story about the whole sector as a whole and how all these big monster companies that were created ahead of 2010 are now just basically getting smaller and smaller, and the workload, there's not much coming through. So, and I mean, it's a Group 5 was on the verge, which may break up at some point. So this is all just a comment about the lack of spend and on fixed spending in the country. So these companies are under much tremendous pressure. There's nothing going through their books. So it's a comment about the whole industry shrinking as it is, as it were.
Is it dead then? Is construction just dead? You not want to be anywhere near it for the next
10
years?
No. I mean, you know, the construction industry is viciously leveraged to the economy. Mm-hmm. And it was arguably on too much of a high prior to 2010. Mm-hmm. And a lot of construction industry books have to do with mining. So mining's in the dumps. So they have peculiar problems beyond just a general malaise in the economy, which would be bad enough. It's a real combination of factors that have made these construction companies. Really turn them. You know, you said they're big companies. Actually, they're not. They're not anymore. You know, and it must be just like, you know, grinding to keep them going.
You imagine? Like, what's the price? Is bigger than all three of them. All three of the major ones.
Yeah.
What's the price on itself?
And I mean, I think it would be a terrible pity if they did break up. I don't see any real solution for them. You know, you could imagine them consolidating a bit, but there's only four or five, big construction or biggish construction companies out there. So consolidation isn't really an option. What they need is a better economy. That is the crucial thing. But as soon as we see that, they might be very good investments.
There's a sense that after December there might be far more investment in the economy, that things might pick up.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, they're also very contingent on government spend. So government has been borrowing like crazy over the last 8 years, and they've just run out of road. You know, so the government was borrowed a lot in order to invest a lot in infrastructure, and for some reason that infrastructure hasn't kicked on. And so now we're sitting with very high debt. Government has basically run out of money. They don't want to admit that, but that's the truth. Mm. And that's hurting. That's the other thing, the other special thing that is hurting the construction industry.
Right. Something that I find interesting is I think CEOs used to have, say, in the 80s and 70s, decades-long experience. They'd be at the top of a firm for years. And nowadays, people do last 3-5 years. Is it a consequence of the stress of the job or the fact that they already make tons of money in that 3 to 5 years that can keep them forever, that they need, that they can afford to leave? Surely the immense rise in executive remuneration over the last couple of decades would contribute towards that, or is that too cynical a view, do you think?
I don't know what the executive remuneration is or was at Avenge or any of the construction companies. But I imagine that not sleeping for 3 years would make you pretty tired. Mm. it's just been a terrible industry. It's not an exciting place to be because the pipeline is not there. You know, the forward projects are not there. Government's much promised 800 billion or up to a trillion infrastructure spend just hasn't kicked in.
So to a less depressing topic, the oil price seems to have recovered in the last week to some extent. It's nearing $60 again, which seems to be good for, it'll be good if you're a shareholder in Sasol, perhaps not the construction companies. But Ron, your thoughts, is this the start of a new period of the oil price spiking back to those ridiculous levels of 3 years ago or not?
Not. We're better praying it's not, because for South Africa, if that shoots up, then inflation shoots up, or this low growth environment, then we have researchers putting up interest rates. So we hope not. But as long as there's a threat about electric car vehicles really coming and this news coming in, and US shale, hopefully it's just fleeting. Well, unless if North Korea does bomb Japan, then clearly it's the way it's going to be. But hopefully not. We don't need this high oil price.
And Tim Cohen has a house in the Karoo, and so you're keen on shale perhaps not being exploited to the extent that I mean, what are your thoughts on shale and its impact on prices? Surely shale, the threat of shale, will keep a ceiling on potential oil price rise.
I think so. I mean, there was a big assumption that if the oil price did go down low enough, that it would blast all of the shale producers out of the market, and then you would get a constriction of supply, which would then kind of lift the oil price. So to some extent that has happened, but this little rise in the oil price now is all about whether or not we're going to have a thermonuclear meltdown, because that would be like bad,
It's a guy called Donald.
I think it's temporary, and I do think that it's not really so much about electric cars. It's just a bigger focus on environmental issues, the cheaper and easier ways to generate power, all of those are sort of slightly kind of kicking in, and they'll ultimately put a lid on the oil price in the medium term.
Okay, so it's a temporary rally, but even that temporary rally has an impact on inflation, like Ron said.
Yeah.
I mean, Ray, I think that it's interesting that now, compared to when the oil price was at ridiculous highs, the rand is a lot weaker. And that'll mean that the oil price rise will affect us more, and we've had an extra fuel levy tacked on when the oil price is very low. I mean, is that not a reason why the Reserve Bank perhaps didn't raise rates last week, that they saw the potential threat of oil filtering into people's pockets at a time where you can't really afford it?
Yeah, I mean, just to illustrate that, when oil spiked, where did it spike to? 1900?
110, I think. 115 was the total.
A litre of gas cost you less at the pump when the oil price is at 110, than it does now.
Yeah, exactly.
At 50, 60. Now that tells you about the rand and the leverage of the rand and the piling in of these levies and increases. The government has seen the fuel as a source of revenue. It's very easy. You put it on, it's instantaneous national tax that is unavoidable. I mean, you can't dodge this unless you stop driving your car or put your fleet, to bed.
Yeah.
So that's the problem.
Well, that's a depressing thought to end on. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us. And remember, don't buy Sasol shares. Tim Cohen told us it's a bad idea. see you next week.